Thank you for joining us for Be Our Geek, where everyone is a geek about something and where we cover your pop culture landscape through our geek lens. I am Ms. Shannon, here with my regular co-host and podcast life mate, Mr. Jayton Satia, executive director of the Twin Cities Film Fest. Hello, Jayton. You're looking lovely as always.
I know, don't I?
You do.
I have this glow to me that I just can't explain.
For anybody that might end up seeing the promos of this, because we do always put a little video out. So Jayton is in his new office. It's very stark still because you haven't had a chance to do anything. And so it looks like you're in like a beige box is what it looks like you're broadcasting out of.
Yeah,
right now.
I got to do a little bit more of something behind me.
Zhuzh it up.
Yep. Do something. Mm-hmm. But I'm liking the new dig so far.
Right. Once we can have people around, I would love for us to do a more formal open house of the new Twin Cities Film Fest studios is what I want to call them. The Twin Cities Film Fest studios.
Yeah, they're studios. Yeah. I mean, we have capacity here for production and for production meetings, and we have breakout rooms and whatnot. But I think we should even do once we're allowed to have, you know, respectable amount of people around us and not just you and I talking to each other.
Right.
But we should probably do a show here and just have some guests here do a live show.
That'd be fantastic. And we have room there. We have fancy cocktails we could do for everybody there. I mean, we get down. That's what we do. We get down.
We do. And I'll bring as many fancy cocktails as you want. If that is a hook to do a show, I'll do that any day.
All right. I am perfect for that. You know, I'm very excited for our guest geek that we have this week. Jayton, you are familiar with this one. I'm not surprising you with our guest geek. And I did. I want to bring up some things that he added into our little response email that I send out. So with us today, writer and director Eric Howell. Hello, Eric. Thanks for joining us. Eric,
hi, thank you, guys.
Should I make sure to use your middle initial? Are there a lot of Eric Howells out there that I need to be concerned and to go with the Eric D. Howell all the time as your moniker?
No, my God. It's terrible. It's a SAG, Screen Actors Guild. I got into the Screen Actors Guild as a stuntman, and there was an Eric Howell already.
Ah.
So I had to use the D, and it's so pretentious. But, and like, you're not the first person to ask that. And I'm just like, the D is silent. It's Screen Actors
and
Guild.
Then you took it a step further, and now as Eric D. Howell III.
Right.
The third.
Well done. Fancy.
You just skipped a second. You just went to a third.
Oh, and my dad's name is Truman Ellsworth Howell.
Oh,
I mean, thank God I'm not a junior, right?
Whoa.
Right? That's a legit name.
There's some gravitas with that.
Your dad's name. That's awesome.
Yes. Yeah. I would. Ooh, I don't know any Trumans
in
real life.
In Minnesota, there's only one Eric Howell.
Round of applause, right. Round of applause for the one Eric Howell. And Jayton, you know Eric because Eric is also one of our fantastic filmmakers here in the Twin Cities. So do you guys remember, what was the last film that you showcased of Eric's at the Twin Cities Film Fest?
Well, we certainly tried our best to showcase Anna's Playground because it had an amazing run. And actually, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, and it was shortlist for best picture, for best short film for Academy Award.
Yeah, it was. It made the last 10. It was, yeah, it did.
Yeah, which is incredible. And then I had the honor of helping Eric with Voices of Stone as well, screening of that, partner screening. Eric is such a, he's just a humble, yet probably one of the most talented filmmakers to have come out of Minnesota in the last couple of decades. So to say that I know Eric, it would be a shame if I didn't. I wouldn't be in the business that I am today. But again, if it wasn't for, we give all the kudos to content creators like Eric. Because of Eric and what he does is why we're alive. And what we do from a business standpoint, from a festival exhibition standpoint. So, and Eric, besides being an amazing director and just a community, again, a community liaison for the industry, he's such a voice in our community, and we need more voices like these now more than ever when everything is built upon rebates and this business. We can show that our own people, much like Eric, and I can name a few other handful of other individuals who truly do work and who truly bring the art here in town, Minnesota. Like, they build it here, they create it here, they create jobs, they create these amazing art pieces that eventually go on to win accolades internationally at festivals. And so we just got to keep pumping away. I'm going to use Eric as much as I possibly can to make sure that we don't lose the rebate, the little rebates that we currently have. And I think Eric would be okay with that as well.
Yeah, it's a struggle, isn't it? It really is this never-ending battle for legitimacy for our community. And I think I was saying that before we got going, is that's what you guys are creating, is this base of community, because we are all, you know, because of the nature of making things, you know, we're going out and about and making projects here, but also elsewhere. But you guys are doing such a great job creating a platform, and those incentives that sometimes are hit and miss in this community really do affect us, really do change the conversations that we get to have on whether or not we're producing projects here. I'm you know, in the midst of one right now, and that debate is happening. So it's a very real thing. So by creating the community that you guys do, it gives hopefully creators out there, you know, creating different narratives, a home base. And that's certainly why I live here. And you know, I did my lovely time in Los Angeles, and I love it. And I still keep a mother-in-law's apartment out there. So I have a presence out there, but you know, this is home, and it's because of what this community has been able to build.
Well, Eric, you and I had not had a chance to meet in person, but I do appreciate you definitely won an award for sending back one of the best response sheets of everyone. So I don't know, Jayden, did you have a chance?
Wait a minute, I don't know what I said now. I better go back and look at that.
Oh, well, no, here, I got it here right here. All right, so I actually, it was so prolific. Normally, I just pull up my notes on my screen and just kind of flip back and forth, but I was this impressed. I used real trees, gentlemen. I used real trees on this one.
You gave her a book to read
because there's like 8 questions, but he did the best. Like, here's an example of some of the answers. I go, hey, now that we're doing this remotely, we use either Skype or Zoom. Please let us know what you prefer. Eric's response was, well, I'm bi, but I prefer Zoom. That was the answer. And I was like, round of applause. Yes, we could do
I'm
that.
I'm willing
for
to
that
experiment.
One.
So
yeah, I was like, I mean, you got all of the ones for that one. I was like,
and you know what? The one thing that I really was like, it made me smile ear to ear, was one of his first thing he said was, sure, you know what? I'm excited to be on the show. Can I have a cigar?
Right.
And can I be drinking? And I'm like, this is a podcast. You can do that anyways,
right.
I suppose. But
you
I guess we are on Zoom
it.
Or it? Skype.
What it's in your house if you don't really, yeah.
Right? But again, he, of course, is smoking a cigar.
Yes.
And has his cocktail.
His whiskey.
A scotch or a whiskey in
whiskey,
front of him.
Yeah.
Whiskey. So kudos
you look
to you,
like,
sir.
You know, after you sent me your headshot, I'm like, if I was going to profile a cigar man and a whiskey drinker, I'm like, Eric D. Howe looks like that dude. Like you,
is that,
like,
the one where is that the one where his headphones are around his neck?
That's one of the I like that one. Like,
you know, a friend of mine taught me. A friend of mine, I'm gonna name. So it's not meant to be a name drop. There's a guy that is he's a sound mixer. His name's Gary Rizzo. He's like won multiple Academy Awards. He's wonderful. He's done all of my films, and he's like he taught me very early on. Said if you're 3 things. Whenever the media takes a picture of you, go to the left side of the picture.
Okay.
So that when they put you under the captions, your name comes first.
Oh, okay. Right. All right.
2, if you're directing, either have a headset on or be pointing. So if you look at the other picture, I think I'm pointing.
Yes.
Those are the images they'll use.
Ooh, that's smart.
I think that is, again, I think everybody listening should be, again, what makes you stand out? What makes your visual perception of you is what you want people to consume?
Right.
I do this all the time where it's, again, not being pretentious. It's I know what I look good in as far as what clothes I look good in, right? Like, people should just know these things.
Right.
Especially with everything with virtual, like you should just be able to light yourself to the best of who you are. Right. So I think those ideas on or those recommendations or those guidance are like, do this and not this.
Right.
Or if you did this instead, or slightly turn your head this way, because everybody has a good side and a bad side. It's all about the parts and all that fun stuff. But I think those are key things to move your career, regardless of what industry you're in, forward.
Well, I think, you know, I had somebody ask me, because normally I'm more of a stage performer as a stand-up comedian. But now we have had to pivot so much into this virtual world that I have my group, my collection of tips and tricks that I have to be able to showcase appropriately on, you know, through the lens. And so you have to use a lot more of your, you know, the skills that I have from being on radio and television than I had to when I was on stage. Because you have to go, how am I going to get, we've just been so trained as human beings when we're looking at things via screen time to divide our attention. And I think that that's something that I want to talk to you about, Eric, because you do film and you've directed music videos and all these things, trying to find a way that you do capture people's attention and keep them glued to that screen when we have really just made that screen be ancillary activity. So it's like, well, you can have this running in the background while I'm folding laundry or while I'm making dinner for the family or while I'm doing something like that. It does seem like now there's so much content, it's hard to make your content be so eye-catching that people stop down and pay attention. So when you're creating your projects, like we can start with Voice from the Stone, because I know you have an interesting story about that as well. Like when you're putting these together, do you really have to think that far in advance, or do you go, I'll create it, then I'll spruce it up if I feel like it needs something?
Well, I'm going to actually quick add, I think Anna's Playground is visually stunning. Okay. I mean, obviously the story is, of course, beautiful, but it's absolutely visually stunning. It takes your breath away with every, it's a short film. It's not a feature length film. So I want to give kudos to Eric and his eye, right? Because when you're on set, you get to see what's on screen, but that again is half the battle.
Right.
After that, then you go into the post and you have to have post in mind when you're shooting a specific scene. And it may absolutely make no sense to the actors there, to the sound guys, right? To be like, what is happening right now? But only the visionary, the director, or even the screenwriter kind of truly know what that visual is going to be for the consumer to not leave their screens.
Right.
And I think Eric does that really well with Anna's Playground and of course with Voices from Stone.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I think Voice from the Stone and Anna's Playground, I mean, everything I think I've done really centers on surrounding myself with, I pride myself in being, first of all, the dumbest person in the room. And you surround yourself with people who I mean, I just did this music video with Amy Lee as well, where all you have to do is get those on-camera performers in front of camera. And so often it becomes about what you don't do, not what you do. And it's a piece of advice I heard from a guy, from David Fincher. I've never met him. It's just something I've read. But he said the hardest thing that we do is to not do something.
Okay.
And I think the reason maybe some of my stuff looks synonymous or has a similar look and feel to it between Anna's Playground and Voice from the Stone and even this latest music video is that I often shoot in an anamorphic cropping, okay, using the wider screen format. And I really like sort of environmental images and portraits that focus on a face, but allow you to see the context in which they're in. And, you know, one of the things I love about Anna's Playground is we had all this amazing background. I have an amazing production designer that I work with named David Weiberg. And he's a local guy with a company called Minifex, MNFX.com. You should check out, they do amazing work. And he built an entire tank out of parts and, you know, like carpet tubes, and I never cut to it. You only see it in the background, but I think when you have that kind of environment around your subject, it draws your eyes to that person in that environment. And I think the human face and the windows of a human eye draw you in. And if you can stop from just cutting around, cut, you know, I'm a little bit of an old schooler in that mentality. I try to edit less. And I think we've gotten into this mentality of everything has to be done in an edit. I think when you watch shows like The Crown, or I just finished Queen's Gambit, amazing.
Great show.
Storytelling. I think the reason for some of my success visually has been to allow the people in front of my camera to do what they do and to not try to get in their way and step on what they do. So therefore, I'm just creating an environment around that performance. And if I can find the right people to put in front of camera, that's usually where I succeed. And then it's just, you know, if you found the right location, it's shooting fish in a barrel, because you put Emilia Clarke in a 1950s wardrobe,
right,
in a castle that was designed for light, you can't lose, right? It's just kind of, you know, just, but it does take a lot of, I mean, to get back to the original question, it takes a ton of prep. I mean, I build, people have commented on, my crew has commented on, I build a book of every scene. I have a whole, in Illustrator, I lay out all of these reference images and every angle we're going to film from that particular scene. So you can go through and you know exactly what we're doing. So you know to dress this much of the frame, if you're watching on Zoom, a bunker.
Right.
Right. Outside of this, it looks fantastic. But anyway, so I'm rambling, but I think that's generally, it's about doing less so often.
Well, speaking of Voice from the Stone, you did share an interesting story with us. And so to tell everybody a little bit about it, I didn't get all the way through it, and I'm going to tell you this. So, and I say this on behalf of all three of us. I know all three of us are parents. Mm-hmm. All of our kids are at a variety of ages. I think my kid is the oldest one. But we see Emilia Clarke, and she's hanging out with this family, and there's a young boy in it. How old is the boy in the story, Eric?
He is 9 or 10.
Okay. And your son is about that age right now, Eric?
My son is 8 now, yeah.
Okay. And Jayton, how old is yours right now?
6 and a half.
Okay. So I want to say this. So I'm watching this film, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. But it did remind me that I really think that one of the creepiest things in the whole world is a creepy kid. Like, there's just something about having it, like when you end up having that, it goes from, like, super, like, okay, he's great, we want to give him hugs, and then it just gets a little weirder and a little weirder, and you're like, should I be concerned that she's in the room by herself with this kid? Like, there's something about kids, and I think that's why it's so scary, is that they're supposed to be so great and charming and beautiful and all this stuff, so that when they turn out to be scary, they're even more scary, because that innocence is lost. So
they're a blank slate.
Right.
They are a blank slate. So if you show a kid, an image of a kid just standing there, and then you show an image of a dead rabbit, you've created a creepy kid. But if
right.
you show an image of a flower, the kid's beautiful, right?
Right.
I mean, it's a little bit of Eisenstein, but it's you know, the filmmaker. But yeah, a kid, we our perceptions we put onto them, and hope versus fear, we hope they're not screwed up, but
exactly.
we're fearful that they probably are.
Right. I try really hard to make sure that my kid doesn't need therapy. And if, like, because I'm like, it's, if he ends up messed up, it's my fault. It's like,
don't try too hard that he'll need therapy.
So mm-hmm. don't hover. You're saying don't yeah, hover just, too much. Okay, fair enough.
Just, you know, let him do him too. But again, I'm coming at it from a parent, of course, but I'm also coming at it from somebody who consumes a lot of content visually. And I watch ages, right? Varietal of ages and different stories and shows. What I'm very intrigued with is how a director handles kids on set.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? Like under, I would say 16 and under is kind of where that's when I start to look at the director more than anything else. If I'm just watching a TV show, just a random Blacklist or something, mm-hmm. right? And there happens to be one of the central character happens to be a kid, or one of the tertiary character happens to be a kid. I get to see what the director is like through the kid's performance.
Right. I agree.
And I think that is amazing.
I agree with you. And again, I think it's about not getting in their way. So we screw kids up. And the thing about kids is you'll get the best performance. The less you mess with them, the more truthful you are with them, the less you'll mess with them. And the fewer takes you're going to get. You don't get a lot with a kid.
Right.
But I'll never forget, I mean, speaking of Anna's Playground, and I've got another anecdote about Edward Dring in Voice from the Stone, but I'll never forget in Anna's Playground, there's a moment, and I'm spoiler alert, so if you're gonna watch, it's on my website if you want to see it, but it's there's a moment where the girl turns and salutes to the sniper who's up in the tower. Mm-hmm. And I remember working with Raven was her name, or is her name. And she said, why, I still don't get why I turn and salute. And I just said, well, you tell me, what do you think? Right. I mean, I didn't tell her.
Right.
She said, well, because I want to see who he is. Yes. Why? Because I want to know where he is. Yes. Why? Because it's going to show my friends where he is. Yes. Why? Because I'm just as much of a killer as he is. And she began to cry. Right. And I mean, it literally, we were just right there with camera and just started camera right away. And she started to cry and she turned and she saluted. And I mean, it was perfect. And she did it so perfectly. And it was just about recording what actually happened.
Right.
And then the opposite end of that, and this is no insult or anything, but I had a scene in Voice from the Stone with Martin and Amelia and Edward. Edward's a 10-year-old kid. Martin Shokash is an amazing actor who you probably know from Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. I forget his name, his elf name, but anyway, and then Amelia. And each one of them is a different actor who works in a different space. So with Amelia, you just say, okay, this one, talk to him as if he's a child abuser. Mm-hmm. Okay, great, she's got that. Martin, okay, you'd have to go into extreme detail. He's a method actor, and you have to go into this amazing detail, and it was you know, intense. And then with Ed, this 10-year-old kid, I'd say, okay, I want you to eat your food the whole time and only once look up to Amelia, and then look at your meal the rest of the time, count to 10, and then walk away, right? Like, it was very didactic.
And yeah,
so it's really about finding that flexibility, finding what kids need, but you just get fewer takes with kids. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get in their way, that's, to me, I found is the key.
And how much of that is, again, you talked a little bit about, you know, pre-production is everything. Pre-production is like, you know, writing notes and writing your kind of visually where you want to be. How often are you interacting with your actors prior to being on set, before their scene? Are you rehearsing much? Are you that kind of director that does, you know, we're going to do three rehearsals, or it's going to be max of three takes, and if we don't get in these three takes, we're going to move on and pick the best one? Or are you kind of one of those guys that says, you know what, we're not, no rehearsal, you guys have already memorized your lines, I'm kind of giving you some direction, just go.
Right.
Yeah, I think I definitely do like a lot of read-throughs, but it's a lot of conversation. It's just a lot of conversation about why and what and the how, not so much, because if they're in the space of understanding the why, the how just kind of delivers itself. And there's so many technicians and all of that that you have to sort of engage with when the actual what is going to happen. I do definitely like to rehearse in the sense of the conversations. And if the actor wants the reads, then absolutely. But right, you kind of let them have that choice. And in the case of Martin and Amelia, Amelia just like, she just memorized anything and, you know, didn't really need, So it really depends on the actor. I guess it's really,
okay.
Yeah, I started
also knowing your actors.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I started as a stunt coordinator, which is about creating a safe space for the physicality of actors to feel safe to perform physically, right? And a director is just taking that and putting it into an emotional space where they feel supported and unafraid to make choices and know that you're gonna get there together eventually. So it's just about creating a space that they feel safe to either rehearse the hell out of or not. But I have a project coming up where it's, you know, I want to do everything in a two shot.
Yeah.
You know, and let them bounce off of each other and not rely on the edit. And I think I want to really rehearse that and deep dive into the rehearsal process so that when we film it, we go.
Right. That has to be an interesting.
I'm intrigued about that.
Right. And that has to be an interesting process when you're going, how am I going to do this one? Like, how often is it about the, when you're looking at the end product, how do you decide that it's, I know you're always probably balancing all these, but is it ever sometimes it's more about the look and sometimes it's more about the dialogue, or do you have to weigh those two choices often, Eric?
The look, when you say the look, it was interesting. I mean, I go back to Voice from the Stone. One of the things my DP always said to me is he'd see me pacing around mm-hmm. behind the monitor, and I'm a pacer.
Right.
And he said, what are you worried about? It's so beautiful. And I said, well, I expect beautiful. I mean, you know, we're going to get, I mean, I really do. Even if it's a gruesome image, I expect it to be aesthetically amazing. Because I think that's what people show up for. They really want to be taken to a different world. But am I creating conflict in a single image? Am I, and so for me, when I'm thinking about the aesthetic, I'm thinking about, is there conflict in the image itself, not just in the performance, or am I supporting the performance? Looking beautiful is sort of like 101, right? It's right. Got to be beautiful. Otherwise you shouldn't even be there, right? That's the baseline. But now, are we creating an image that creates conflict without saying a word? And that was beautiful about Anna's Playground, is that there's no dialogue in it, right? It's 18 minutes, no dialogue, requires no language skills, but it's full of conflict.
Right.
And so to me, it's creating that third idea. Show the banana peel, show the woman walking, show the banana peel, show the woman walking. We've created a third idea and create attention by doing that. So I guess I'm always asking, are we creating tension or drama just visually without even needing an edit is usually what I'm trying to find.
Right. Well, you have lots of projects that are going on. I want to get to your most recent project, Revolutions of Cassandra, which is completely different than what we've talked about so far. But I do have another question, because you've had the opportunity to interact with the amazingly talented Amy Lee from Evanescence on mm-hmm. more than one occasion. So was it Voice from the Stone? Was that your first interaction with her when she was working on the closing track?
Yeah, it was cool. It was the greatest. Might be. It's one of the pinnacles of my creative life is to make something that influences another piece of art. And I was with my team. We had the good fortune of mixing at Skywalker Ranch. Mm-hmm. We're the only people there. I think there was one other project there. And it's this big ranch, and we have the whole place, and we're thinking about who should do the closing track. And we made a short list of three women that would be great: Pink, Alanis Morissette, and Amy Lee. And mm-hmm. I said, I'd really like to get Amy Lee, because it's her voice that like is most inspiring to me.
Right.
The other two are kind of pop queens, but Amy's voice says something.
Right.
So I sent a link and a letter, and she ended up calling us during the mix, and I was freaking out. And she said, I love it. Tell me what you want. I said, this is a love story, not a horror film. This is a love story about a mother who refuses to leave her son. Mm-hmm. And I want when we cut to black, I want the first thing the audience to hear is the sound of a mother's voice.
Right.
Calling to her son. She hung up, and I don't know, a day later, she had the first 40 seconds of Speak to Me,
right.
Which is the song. And we were just, you know, bawling our eyes out, and we flew her out, and she came out to Skywalker, and they gave us the keys to the recording studio. Which is kind of a big deal, because this place is like a mecca, right? Yes. And so they gave us, we had access to their winery, and we had, like, it was this total pretentious, and we were cooking food, and she was riding, and we'd ride bikes around the ranch, and then we'd go and record, and then it just kind of became this fairy tale. And we went back and shot the music video for it at the actual location. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of years later, I wrote a project called The Revolution of Cassandra. Mm-hmm. And I can, you know, I'll tell you about how Amy got involved first.
So let me do this. So this will bring us up to speed, because we don't have the rights to this, but I do have a piece of it. So we're not going to play the whole thing, obviously. But I do have a piece of Amy Lee's Speak to Me from Voice from the Stone.
Space between is just a dream. You will never be alone. I will always be waiting, and I'll always be watching. We are
Maybe I picked the part that made you cry, Eric. I'm not sure if I picked that part, but it is amazing and haunting, and she does have a fantastic, fantastic voice. So you obviously have a great eye and ear for the talent that should be involved in your projects.
Yeah, God, it was life-changing. At that moment, I mean, to hear someone watch your film and then to send you that as a response to what they experienced in the film. And there's a horror story that goes along with it on how marketing people decided to sell it as a horror film.
Right. I want to talk about that because you didn't describe it that way at all. Like the way that you describe it, like it's this gothic haunting romance about a son and missing his mom and all these things. But that's not what they decided to do when they put it out. Right, Eric?
Yeah. Yeah. It was awful. It was honest to God. It's like I could, if I went there, if I didn't have the whiskey and cigar, it would hit my heart really hard. That project was so close to me, and I was hired to make a haunting romance, a maternal romance, not creepy like mother son, but like genuinely a mother who refuses to leave her son even after death.
Right.
That's what the story's about. And another woman coming to try to help the son, and the idea that there has to be this closure before that kid can move on. And also the idea that the nurse that comes to help can't be a mother and desires to have her own relationship with a kid as a maternal figure in a child's life. So it really is this maternal love story. And you know what happens in the business is a distributor picks it up and says, well, if we sell this as a horror film the opening weekend in the US with Emilia Clarke, and we can show her topless for you know X amount of time. Mm-hmm. Well, then we've got our money back,
right.
And we can live another day. They're not interested in the film; they're interested in making their opening weekend, and therefore, you know. And then, of course, every critic in the world goes, "Well, this isn't a horror film,"
right?
You know, and they get pissed off, but they don't care. So it is what it is. But that started a relationship with Amy and I.
Mm-hmm.
Amy and me. What is it?
Me.
Anyway, Amy and I.
Yeah.
I always get that one bad. Like, but I sent her another script after that project was done called The Revolution of Cassandra, and this is a story about essentially about being for something, not against everything.
Right.
And. She I said, look, I'm not going to be able to get this made as a feature film. It's a big budget. But would you have a look at it? And, if you like it, if you respond to it, would you write the foreword to the graphic novel that I'm turning it into? And she calls me back a week later. And she was truly affected by it and was just, couldn't have been more effusive and said, absolutely, I'll write the forward to this. And I didn't hear from her for a month. And then she calls me back and she sends me the song called Use My Voice. And she said, I can't write a forward, but your story is affecting how I'm writing this song. Mm-hmm. This song, I'm having problems with the chorus because I keep singing about what I'm against, not what I'm for. And I think I need to rethink about how I'm approaching the song because of what you're saying in the story. So it was another moment of, wow, we've connected on a creative level. And she sent me the song and we started talking about the ideas and the themes in it. And then finished it and it started out as going to be an Amy Lee song. And she said, you could just use it to promote your graphic novel. And then she called me one day, she said, you know what, the band loves it. They want to make it an Evanescence song. Would you direct the video? And I, of course, yeah.
And how was that? Because you directed that recently. So then our new COVID reality and being on set and keeping everybody safe and all of that. How was that process, Eric?
It was miserable. It was the hardest shoot I've ever done. Mm-hmm. It was awful. I mean, so it is a story called Use My Voice. It's about using your voice for what you believe in and not rolling over and not speaking. It's about standing up and using your voice. So having masks on was never an option,
right?
Like you can't sing Use My Voice, and especially in this political climate. And so we designed it with that in mind, with COVID in mind. And we wanted this idea that people people are the light. When there's darkness around and the truth is being extinguished, we needed her to be a light. And right. and so we created this motif, as you'll see in the video, of her sort of lighting a torch in the darkness and walking that torch along, and the other band members also illuminating and trying to be a point of light. And then when we actually filmed it, I built maps. Again, in Illustrator, I geek right. out and do all these. I built maps for all of the extras and I sent it to them digitally so they would all show up on set and place themselves
right.
at safe distances from each other. And then I could set my camera up. I had already had all of the angles set, so I could set my camera up and say, okay, everyone remove your mask. And they were all 8 feet apart or more mm-hmm. than eight. And because I was using that wide format again, that widescreen format, I just filled my frames accordingly
right.
and allowed them to move around. And as long as they kept moving, it felt like we were in a large crowd, but we were always very separate from each other.
Right. Well, I have a little piece of that one as well. So here's Evanescence with Use My Voice.
Cover my ears and close my eyes. Just long enough to stop the noise. Take everything and throw it away, but I will use my voice.
That's awesome.
Yes, it's amazing. And the video is amazing. We'll make sure we link to that on our page when you follow this. It is
And
amazing.
I got to say, the opening lines, you cut it off right there. Drowning the truth in an ocean of lies.
Mm-hmm.
Label me a bitch because I choose to draw my own lines.
Right.
Burn every bridge and build a wall in my way, but I will use my voice. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how she writes this stuff, but it is spot on and gives you chills when you hear it. And so to have that... to have my story influence or have some relevancy in that process was another pinnacle for me, just creatively as an artist, to be able to connect with another artist like that was really a privilege.
And that it built from a graphic novel, Your Revolutions of Cassandra. Everybody can get the first three portions of it, right? So we're gonna have a six book arc, right, for this, Eric?
Correct. It started as a screenplay that won some awards,
mm-hmm.
and it's called The Revolution of Cassandra. You can find it at revolutionofcassandra.com, and it is a single story that has been broken up into six episodes, six volumes.
Right.
So eventually, come February, we'll have all six volumes released, and it will be one complete sort of tabletop graphic novel. And it's just a story about two sisters who end up standing up for what they believe in and end up changing the world around them.
Right. And it still has that little bit of that, we'll call it for, because I don't want to spoil it for anyone, that sci-fi-ish fantasy, like, undertone to it. Do you really enjoy that genre? Because I feel like you dabble in that quite often, where it's not a full-on, you know, sci-fi explosion, but it'll have that thread throughout it.
Well, for me, I like analogies. I like metaphor. I really enjoy metaphor. And so to me, you know, with this and with Anna's Playground, it's a world that we recognize. It's a
right.
world that exists and a world we can empathize with, but there's a fictitious nature to it.
Right.
So this story takes place in a fictitious Central American country. And the protagonists live in this country and they basically... Cassandra and her sister Moira trade whiskey for humanitarian aid, and the sister who believes in nothing, Moira, rolls loaded dice and wins whiskey through gambling, while Cassandra is the true believer in all things astrology, and
right.
when Mercury is in alignment with Saturn, you know, all things are possible, and she's kind of annoying in some degree because her beliefs are so strong, but
right.
the two of them trade whiskey for humanitarian aid, and by doing this, end up changing the world that they live in. And so if I put that in a very specific space, people could politicize it. People could turn it into something it's not intended to be. So I do like that. I do appreciate creating my own realities so that I can take away the rules of the real world.
Like adding in that slightly supernatural aspect gives you more license to play with it. And exactly. One of the things I thought interesting when I was reading through the graphic novels that are available now, like your foreword in the first one, like explaining why you made the decision to have characters that would be considered from our BIPOC community or weren't, you know, typical cis, you know, Caucasian American characters. And I really appreciated your foreword on that. So do you want to go into that a little bit of like why you decided to set it as these characters, as these particular people?
Yeah, Shannon, this is the thing that I was most excited about talking to you about, because I want to pick your brain.
Uh-huh.
Because here I am, I'm a white privileged male. Mm-hmm. There is no question. I grew up with privilege. I live with it today. Mm-hmm. There's nothing those of us who have it can do about it, but we can recognize that we have it.
Right.
And understand how that plays out. At the same time, I spent a lot of time earlier in my career documenting kids living in abject poverty around the world. I've been all around the world and photographed and filmed children living in the most crazy poverty you could ever imagine. And that's what influenced this story. And when I created the characters of Cassandra and her sister Moira, it was important that they not be the great white savior.
Right.
That they be of this place, but have a foot in American culture, that they maybe grew up in both of these places. They were born in this fictitious Spanish-speaking country. They're bilingual. They are Latina.
Mm-hmm.
But their sisters who happen to speak Spanish, their sisters who happen to be Latina,
right.
They're not Latina sisters. Like, I'm not trying to tell a Latina story culturally.
Right.
And hopefully that's very obvious. I mean, that's been a real big debate,
mm-hmm.
Among people, you know, reading it. Well, are you trying to tell a Latina story? I'm not. And
right.
and I've spent a lot of time sharing it with the Latino community. And there's no offense, because it isn't trying to be a Latina story.
Right.
But I really appreciate the fact that these heroes, you know, they're female, they live in this space. And I think there's a difference between appropriation and appreciation.
Agreed.
And walking that line is super important so that we don't close the doors on each other.
Right. And what I felt from reading it, you know, one, as someone who grew up in this geek community and not feeling that there was enough representation, but do feeling that, you know, I do think that it is important to have members of the privileged side of the community amplify the voices and the messages of the marginalized side. And so I do appreciate it when we do have more representation, because we don't live in a micro community where it can all be for us by us. So it is a matter of, do you tell this story? And then by you telling the story, they show that it is profitable to have these types of characters, so that then when a Latina or Latino designer says, no, I want to champion this, then they also can prove that these stories would have a following and a readership. So until the story gets told a little bit, then you don't get the opportunity to say, no, it can work. And then I think that it's, you know, we have more female driven superhero movies now, because we have finally got to the point that we had enough of them that they were allowed to fail and not be perfect. And so now we can have, and that required, you know, cis white males to make some. And then because of that, now we can have women that lead them. You know, we had enough tokenized, you know, BIPOC characters that they're like, nobody turns off the screen when we have these characters, so we can have the non-token version. And so I find it a very imperfect way to get what we want, but I think that that is the best route. So I appreciated the way that you did it, that and even reading that, I found it very insightful and impactful to go, this is why I created a country. This is why I didn't want to turn this into a Wikipedia article of here's what I think it's to be, what it's like to be Latinx. You didn't do that. And so I appreciated that, and being able to say these characters exist and they are strong and they have agency. I think it does require more filmmakers and content creators like you to go, I get it. I'm going to tell this story so somebody else can tell it as well.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult. I've been concerned about it because I don't want to hijack a culture.
Right.
And we've even, you know, there's ancient culture within the story itself that we've completely fictionalized. It's not Inca. It's not
right.
It's not Mayan. It's its own entity. But I think there's this fear that we've now created that we can't, you know, who am I to write about two sisters, right? Like, what do I know about two women? Well, I'm married to a Gemini, so I just wrote my wife
right.
in two parts,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. Like, literally, just, and then I get to go in and argue with her. So, you know, it is definitely from my experience, but I wanted to make a Laura Croft in dreadlocks and Birkenstocks, mm-hmm. right? Like, one that doesn't use a gun.
Right.
One that is truly a female, from my perspective, that doesn't use force, that doesn't just use pick up a gun and wear tights, and right. like it's a different kind of superhero.
Right.
And so I want that to be empowering. I've been very interested in how the BIPOC community is going to respond to it. Again, I've done my own testing
right.
and things like that, but you never know. Mm-hmm. To put it out there to the world and to not hide that I'm a white guy
right.
who wrote it. Right. I'm not trying to fool anyone. I'm not trying to, you know, let's put it through the ringer.
Right.
And so far the response has been fantastic.
Right. I was feeling it. Like, I got through the first three. And I'm like, okay, I can see where this is going. You know, as a fan of graphic novels and comic books in general and all those things, it's very in my wheelhouse. And it's been, you know, interesting to me. Like, I like seeing the world building that you've done in Revolutions of Cassandra. And to be able to, I also like tackling what is quote unquote, and Jayton and I talk about this all the time, quote unquote, heavy topics in these formats, because I think that it's a way for us to continue to have conversations about things. And because otherwise people go, it doesn't have anything to do with me, so I don't want to talk about it. So, or I don't, you know, it doesn't get into their frame. And being able to have a quality graphic novel that has this kind of story, I think, is a good way to get in front of and get more eyes on these conversations. And I appreciate that. So I don't know if you expected me to read the foreword and to read the whole thing that you did, but of course I did, because I'm a nerd.
And I think it also brings in a unique audience too, right? Mm-hmm. It brings in a different audience that you typically wouldn't be able to read just from film or just from a novel. So I think it has more of an effect than you think it does, because of a different breadth of an audience is actually right. taking a look at it. And at the end of the day, everybody's a human being. Everybody's experiencing these things, but everybody doesn't want to talk about it
right.
in a certain way. They all want to have the conversation. They're not shunning away from it. But it's not the platform they choose
right.
to have the conversation in. That's not what they feel comfortable in. So I think a graphic novel, in tackling the subjects that you are, actually expand the conversation to a wider audience.
Right. And it's been done before. Like, if we look back to the more serious graphic novels, like even if we go back to Mouse about the Holocaust and these other things, I think that there's lots of room for that genre. And I was just curious, how do you go from, I do short films, feature films, to I'm going to do this graphic novel? Like, how did you go, I have this script and I can't make it a movie. Like you said that, you know, I'm not going to be able to do it that. How did you go, I'm going to pivot it into a graphic novel?
Well, I was approached by the same people who got behind Anna's Playground. And they said, look, we're shocked by what happened with this election. This was in 2016. We want to respond to this through art. And can you make another short film? And I said, no,
right.
I don't want to try to emulate what we did with Anna's Playground, because Anna's Playground, if you notice, also takes place in a fictitious place.
Right.
It doesn't exist. And there's it's multi-ethnic with regard to the cast. So I said, look, this is a story that is perennial. That's about something larger than whoever won political office. This is something bigger than that. This is about humanity. And this is about how we connect with one another, or we don't connect. The opening line of the graphic novel is, for as long as anyone can remember, people have been doing the wrong things for the right reasons.
Right.
And, you know, I wrote this as a response. I needed some levity in a popcorn movie.
Yeah.
After writing Anna's Playground, I needed some levity, but I still wanted to have efficacy, and I still wanted it to be pertinent to the conversation about climate, the conversation about who's right, who's wrong, the conversation about what we can learn from each other, even when we're in opposition. So I wrote a character. I wrote Cassandra as a character that I don't necessarily agree with her.
Right.
But what I do agree with is that she believes in something bigger than herself.
Right.
And her sister doesn't. And that's really the story arc of these two characters is the sister who believes in something is much like Forrest Gump in that she changes the world around her and she changes those around her because she truly believes in her heart what she believes. And I think that's what we need more of in this world, not to steamroll each other, but to understand each other and to be open to listening to one another. And that's what this action adventure, this action romance is meant to encapsulate. And it was fun because now I get to put a little bit more of my voice in it. When converting it from a screenplay to a graphic novel, there was a character that I got to amplify, and that's the little girl. There's this whole thing is told as a book report, and the little girl gets to have a voice now, and that gets to be my voice. And so it's kind of fun. I get to be a little bit more on the nose creatively with sort of my opinions and my viewpoints.
Well, personally, I love it. And everyone can find it. It's Revolutions of Cassandra. You can get that now. The first three episodes and then the first three volumes. And then book four is going to come out in December. Is that right?
Yeah, in December. It's Revolution of Cassandra.
The Revolution of Cassandra. My apologies. The Revolution of Cassandra. You can get book four when it comes out in December. And then you said five and six will be out probably by the end of January.
Correct. Before Valentine's Day. That's our goal. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, this is a perfect thing for Valentine's Day. Here, everybody. Think about something. So other than that, I mean, I know I wanted to get to a bunch of your hobbies, but you're just going to have to promise to come on the show again, Eric, because you are a fascinating, fascinating person. And I want to talk about some of the other things that you adore. Is that okay for you?
I would love that. I've got a list of questions here for you guys. I was going to pick your brains.
Too funny. Okay, you can do one question. One question. What do you want to start with?
Well, okay, so it pimps. So again, this is because I love having this community, and you're, you know, person of color. I've got a question for you because it came up. I'm watching with my 8-year-old son and my wife, Kim's Convenience. Have you guys seen this?
I haven't yet. Okay.
I have.
Okay.
Okay, so this is appropriation versus appreciation.
Right.
This is totally ethics 101. My wife and I got into a debate about this last night because... So I don't know if you know that the setup is basically it's a Canadian family in Toronto. It's Canada's number one sitcom.
Right.
And it's a single camera comedy about a Korean convenience store. And it's phenomenal. It's I don't know if you've seen it, Jayden. Have you seen any episodes?
I've seen one.
It's phenomenal. It's really just
great. It's absolutely fantastic.
Family dynamics of this Korean family. And I think there's four seasons. I don't know. There's a lot of them. It's wonderful.
Right.
So we were laughing about it later, and I mimicked a line spoken by the mother.
Yes.
Who said, "We sing for Jesus." And I said it in a Korean accent.
And your wife said, "Stop that."
What's that?
And your wife said, "Stop that."
No, I stopped it. I said, "Wait a minute. Okay, now am I parodying a character? Am I being culturally insensitive? If like, I'm not poking fun, but the way she says it and the way she speaks and the way she is, and it's being performed, it caused me to go, but that's not right for me to say that.
Right.
To say it like that. It just caused a conversation. I don't know the answer, but it was like.
Okay. I have an opinion, obviously. Our opinions are just our opinions. So Jayden, do you want to go first? You want me to go first?
I mean, I'm torn. I could see, again, we mimic lines all the time, right? We say our famous lines all the time. Just because Jack Nicholson said it, we're trying to be, you know, you don't know the truth. Like, we do our best to, again, mimic the characters of our favorite stories all the time.
Right. Now,
you know, I can't say what Dave Chappelle says
right
on his stand-up comedies. I appreciate it. I laugh because it's funny. That intent was fun.
Right.
But I know that I can't say those, even as a joking to myself, you have to pause. Like, that is not for me to say.
And I'm a bit, I've given this advice to actor friends of mine and storyteller friends of mine. If you don't have to do an accent, if the story does not hinge upon that accent, then you stay away from it. Because quite often we think that for the line to be funny when I say it, it has to be that way. And so you lean into the accent because it's low-hanging fruit. And I usually tell people, you don't need that. Like, if there's, you know, I have a storyteller friend of mine that had a story where they didn't need the accent at all except for one particular line. Because the way that the word was said caused a misunderstanding. And I said, but if you take the accent out when you're talking about the person the whole rest of the time, the story is still sound. And so that's what I would tell you, Eric. If you don't need it, then just don't. And because I, you know, even in, you know, because I like to practice what I preach. I'm that person. And so, like, even when, and I'm not a fan of making people costumes or making people, like, so if you want to dress up like I'm a fan of the Black Panther movie, it would be appropriate for me to be one of the characters because it would not require blackface. Even though that would probably make sense, I still was like, no, I want to be in this world. So I came up with a variation of what I call Wakandan royalty. Or if I dress up, then I'll pick a Dora Milaje because there's multiple ones. I'm not being a person. Because I think in general, people shouldn't be costumes is what it is. So, okay.
Amen. That's sage advice. That was the conversation was, wait a minute. I'm literally enjoying this and I'm like laughing and I'm embracing and I don't want to mock and I don't want to make fun of. So where's that balancing? I think that's sage advice. I think that's exactly the right space to be in.
So who would you, if you loved this Kim Convenience world, who would you be to fit in this world? And I think that that's where you come from. And that's how you go. And I think that we're imaginative enough human beings that we can do that. We just don't. Like, a lot of times we go, well, it's easiest just to say, well, I'm Wonder Woman. I'm like, no, you can be a Spider-Man. You don't have to be Miles Morales. How about that? Right. You know, kind of thing. You can figure out how you fit into it. So just use one more ounce of imagination so that you could get in there. And I, you know, because I want all these things to be out there. And the point is that we are showcasing that these stories about a variety of families and communities and cultures can be funny to people outside the culture. And we have to remind people that because, you know, we as someone who's in a more of a marginalized community, I was imaginative enough to be able to watch Dukes of Hazzard, and my life experience had nothing to do with that, but I could still enjoy the show. And so I think it's reminding people you can still enjoy it even though it's not your particular history and you're not seeing yourself reflected in this show, but you can still get it and think it's great and enjoy it and just reminding people of that.
I love that. It's great advice. I strongly recommend checking it out because you'll laugh your head off. And it's great. It's, you know, there's no such thing, to your point, I love that when we got through the 90s, we got past gay love stories.
Right.
We just got into love stories.
Exactly.
Whether or not they're between men and women, women and women.
Right.
I can empathize with love and I can understand that. And that's, I feel it's fortunate. We're fortunate to be part of this conversation that's moving forward to those kinds of places.
Agreed. And I would love to continue this conversation. So we're going to have you on again. We should plan for sure after volume 6 of The Revolution of Cassandra drops. So around like Valentine's Day, I think, Jayden, we should have him on.
Ooh,
and we could
Valentine's
talk about love.
Day conversation.
That'd be good.
Yes.
Because you guys, then I can live through you guys. You guys can tell me what you're going to do because you're successfully relationship. I do not anticipate being successfully relationship by February. I'll be honest with you.
Think about it that way. Come on,
Shannon. No, I'm not.
I'm wishing you a crush by Valentine's Day.
Okay, maybe a crush. But here's the thing. Like, I told Jayden this. I am on no new friends status right now because of our current systems. So for anybody to swoop in. I'm not even out there to find me right now. I'm like, how many masks do you have? I just bought
grocery
new masks.
Store.
Right.
Grocery store.
No.
Grocery
I'm just gonna
store, exactly.
Grocery and store.
Your Bite Squad delivery person.
Oh, goodness. That's what I want. I want that particular adult film to happen. So he brought my DoorDash. He looked lovely behind his mask. He had the best eyes. So, no. I'm not. I doubt that's going to happen between now and Valentine's Day, but that's okay. I got plenty of things to keep me copy. I need to finish reading the rest of The Revolution of Cassandra. I need to catch up on Kim's Convenience. there's a lot of things that I need to do. I got plenty. I need to, you know, teach my 12-year-old all his Zoom school lessons. I'll be fine without somebody hanging out. So, again, everybody go check out The Revolution of Cassandra. Jayton, in the meantime, do we want them to go ahead and check out? We just dropped, by the time this comes out, we are going to be moving into December. And in December, you said that we are going to have some special TCFF streams activity going on, right?
Yeah, so we had some amazing reception to a lot of the content that we showed during the festival in October. And we have 6 to 8 films that are part of encore screenings for the month of December that are available right now on Twin Cities Film Fest streams. And these are films that exclusively played at our festival. And these filmmakers had such a great time and there was such a demand for it that we're actually bringing them back for encore screenings. And what we're doing here is we're actually revenue sharing with the filmmakers to, again, give back to the artists over and over again. Our goal is to continue to feed the artists again. So the encore screenings, if you watched it and you paid the festival, right, the festival earns its money from ticket sales, mm-hmm. which is known during the festival, and you really liked it. And if you want to watch it again, buy it again. But you know now that it were directly revenue sharing all the proceeds for the month of December with these encore screenings.
That is fantastic. You can get that information on our website, TwinCitiesFilmFest.org. And Eric, we appreciate you being part of the show today. We're very excited to see everything that you have going on, because I know there's some other stuff that we didn't really like get into yet. So I'm sure we're glad that you're keeping busy. All of our filmmaker friends, all of our content creator friends, we are very happy that they have found a way in this new universe that we're living in to keep themselves busy and up and running. And so thank you for what you've done. Thank you for what you did on the music video to keep all of the actors and the performers safe and figuring it out. And thank you for telling some BIPOC stories with The Revolution of Cassandra.
And thank you for creating community. It's a truly an honor to sit here with you guys and chat. I'm really grateful.
We already said you could come back, Eric. We already said.
I just want to know what a DoorDash guy does when he sees your swords. That's all. Like, does he like run?
If he runs, then he was the wrong one. That's it. He needs to say, I can add to the collection. Otherwise, he's the wrong dude.
Geek line, there can be only one, Shannon.
Exactly. You think I hadn't thought that through, Eric? Come on. But we appreciate everybody. Remind you, you can find this episode and previous episodes if you go to our Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also email us, brgeekshow@gmail.com. We are at brgeekshow on all of the socials. And you can even leave us a message if you go to 612-276-2774. Do not tell me what I should get on my DoorDash. Just use that if you want to leave us a message. We encourage you to like and subscribe to Be Our Geek wherever you find us. And again, you can find this and more at our website, TwinCitiesFilmFest.org. Eric, thank you for joining us. Jayton, you know I adore you as always. I'm going to see everybody soon. See you next time on Be Our Geek, because everyone is a geek about something.